On February the 28th, Man Martin, author of Days of Endless Corvette, came to Bowling Green to discuss his book. This is the 5th annual One Campus, One Community, One Book event sponsored by the Southern Kentucky Book Fest's partners, namely WKU Libraries, Bowling Green Public Library, and Barnes & Noble Booksellers. Dr. Martin first spoke in the Corvette Museum, then WKU's Helm Library and Bowling Green Public Library. Here's an excerpt of the introduction given by Tracy Harkins, manager of WKU Library's Community Outreach at the Helm Library.
We're so glad that you're all here for this One Book event. Some of you I saw at the kickoff, which seems like a really long time ago, but it wasn't that long ago. And of course, we did not have the author with us then, and today we are fortunate to have him. Again, my name's Tracy Harkins, and I'm the Community Outreach Manager here at WKU Libraries, and I help out with projects like One Book. And I did want to tell you a little bit about Man Martin. Man, as I mentioned if you were here previously, is short for Emmanuel, and he is a native of Florida and Georgia, but his mother was born here in Kentucky, so he has a Kentucky tie, which we like to have for our One Book presentations. And of course, his book centers around this classic 1953 Corvette. And as home to the Corvette here in Bowling Green, our committee that picked out the book thought it was really appropriate to have that as a selection. Days of the Endless Corvette is Man Martin's first novel, and he was a cartoonist and created a syndicated comic strip before turning to fiction. He studied writing at Kennesaw State University and Georgia State University and recently completed his PhD, so he is Dr. Man Martin. He teaches high school English and coaches debate, and he lives with his family in Dunwoody, Georgia, right outside of Atlanta, and we are so glad he is here today to talk with you about Days of the Endless Corvette.
Diana McQuitty, WKU Library's writer-in-residence, made the following remark about Dr. Martin's book while introducing him in the Corvette Museum.
Days of the Endless Corvette is Man Martin's debut novel. The manuscript came from his dissertation when he worked on his and earned his MFA in creative writing from Kennesaw State University. Before that, he was awarded the Flannery O'Connor Writing Scholarship at Georgia College. He also holds another MFA in graphic design from the University of Georgia and is currently working toward a PhD in writing at Georgia State. Mann's nationally syndicated comic strip, Sibling Revelry, ran from 1988 to the mid-1990s, and his writing and drawings have appeared in numerous publications. Rumor has it that Mann personally drove Earl Mulcahy's Mystic Corvette from Humboldt County to Bowling Green. He lives in Atlanta, but today he is a Kentuckian as he brings the humor and beauty of Days of the Endless Corvette to the city of the Corvette. Please join me in welcoming Mann Martin.
Here's Dr. Mann Martin speaking at the museum. He later gave the same presentation in WKU's Helm Library and Bowling Green Public Library.
Thank you for that. Just a wonderful introduction. I'm going to correct one thing.
Okay.
I have a PhD. So, you all address me now as Dr. Martin. And what I thought I'd do is... unasked, I'll tell you just a little bit about how I came up with this story, the process of writing, and then I'll do a short bit from it, as she said, and answer questions if you all have any. I'm a home fix-it man around my house, and if you knew me, you would realize how deeply hilarious that is. I honestly should not be trusted with anything sharper than round-nosed scissors, but notwithstanding that, I've put in hot water heaters, I've done electrical work and plumbing, I've put in gas ranges and ice makers and hung ceiling fans, and at any moment you'll hear this cacophony as various things in my house explode, fall over, collapse, and break apart. And every time that I would put something together, repair it, my wife would say in this little nervous, tremulous voice, "Honey, what are these leftover parts for?" And I'd say, "Darling, there's always leftover parts." And of course in our basement, we have any number of little plastic containers full of bolts and block washers and gaskets and whatnot that didn't seem to go in when I repaired the ice maker. That's where the idea came to me, that there are always leftover parts. And the The principal character in the story, Earl Mulvaney, believes that if he will take apart and reassemble the same 1953 Corvette, and there's actually one just outside this door over and over again, that eventually, he saves the leftover parts every time, that eventually he'll have enough pieces to build an entire car. And once I had that germ of an idea, I had to ask myself, why would somebody, even in a tall tale world where things like this might be possible, why would you undertake such a thing? And there are only two possible reasons for this. It's either money or love. And money is not enough to drive a story. It had to be love. And so that was the sort of genesis of the story. Once I knew I had a story with the beginning and the middle and an end, or at least I thought I knew what the end was, you know, from start to finish, it took me about 2 years to write it out and to send it to an agent, and then another year after that before publication. Anyway, I'll tell you a little bit. I don't do readings. I do recitals. I'm just going to tell you something. Earl Mulvaney is in love with a girl next door. Her name is Ellen. Unfortunately, Ellen had married another boy named Troy Badcock in what in Sandersville, Georgia, we used to call a shotgun wedding. Nobody in town made fun of that. They didn't joke about the fact that her dress fit just a little tight across the middle. And if the bridesmaids didn't run to catch the bouquet when Ellen threw it, they didn't scatter like pigeons either. Everyone was determined to do the right thing, so all in all, matters could have turned out worse. Now, what I'm going to tell you about today is how Troy Badcock fell in love with his wife the day of his daughter's baptism. Now, it's unusual to do it that way, because most men fall in love with their wives when they're girlfriends, and if they're lucky, they stay in love with them once they become wives. But Troy did it the other way around. Now, Troy was still in the Mighty Mites in Pop Warner's football league when he learned his second rule of life. It was a day, late autumn, when the leaves were changing and the air was just as sweet and cold as a red delicious apple. Troy waited for the ball to get snapped, and then BAM! Troy was hit by Bob Cook like a freight train, and he hit the hard green ground, trying to catch a breath. The air was no longer sweet. And the coach came over, and this was not Coach Fuller, it was before that, it was Coach Martin. And she looked down at him through that little helmet, the little window formed by his helmet, and she said, "Now stay low, legs wide, knees bent. Now that'll learn you, I expect." And it had learned him. And the lesson had served him well from that day to this. But the morning of his daughter's baptism, there was dew on the grass, and 1,000 spiderweb hammocks were stretched out between the blades. And Ellen handed a wild violet to Eddie Cummings' daughter. And the sight hit Troy's chest as hard as Bob Cook had all those years ago. Could anyone be as beautiful as Ellen? She cradled Jennifer against her chest. She was wearing a white muslin dress, and she bent down her legs straight, bending down from the waist to reach a wild violet to Candy Cummings' dimpled hand. And there were 100 things he loved about her. Like the way when something touched her heart, she'd do the same with her hands on her chest and her elbows out. Now, he couldn't have told you why he thought of that just then, or why he wanted just then to touch her heart or to hold her hands and his against his own heart. Now, you're probably going to tell me that that one moment, the white dress, the violet, the dewy grass, was not in itself enough to love somebody, and love must have been sneaking up on him a little at a time, except he hadn't noticed till then, and I expect you'd be right. I think the same phenomenon accounts for how Ellen fell in love with Troy one night years later, after learning always cook beans thoroughly before you put them in tomato sauce or they never will get done. It was a night in August when both the window units were on the fritz and they just couldn't get cool. Ellen was wiping out a crock pot in the kitchen, and Troy was watching the Grays on TV when they heard their daughter's sudden cry. Troy made it to the bedroom first, and they had seen prettier sights, I can tell you. It would have been bad enough if Jennifer had merely upchucked the two bowls of chili she'd had for supper, but her parents had put an oscillating fan by her bed to keep her cool. Weeks later, Ellen was still finding kidney beans under the dresser, under the bed, stuck in the crown molding. And little Jennifer just sat in the bed and wailed. The most terrifying experience she'd ever had. First being sick, and then getting stuck in a crossfire of ricocheting kidney beans. Well, Ellen bent down to wipe the chili off the baseboards before it could harden. And Troy gingerly lifted his daughter out of the bed. She looked like she'd been dipped in chili. And he was trying to decide, should he rinse her off in the bathtub, the sink, or just hose her down outside? But Jennifer would not stop crying. And she reached for her daddy with trembling arms and said, "Daddy! Daddy!" And that's when Jennifer had her moment. Troy Badcock, who in his prime had knocked the toughest linemen in the state flat on their ass, tender, pressed his puke-caked daughter to his chest and said, "There, there," and kissed away her tears. Thank you all so much for your kindness. That's what I was going to do. I will entertain questions. I will talk at length. Anything you be warned, if you ask me a question, I will answer it at length because I'm a school teacher, so I love the sound of my own voice. Do y'all have any questions? Yes, sir.
Yeah, one of the funniest characters in the book, I think, and tragic too, of course, is the mother, Ruby.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the funniest things to me in the book is the famous scene where she's lying on the floor and he has to decide how he's going to get her to the hospital. Can you talk a bit about how you conceived that?
I'm glad you liked that scene. Yeah. That was an early problematic scene, yeah, you know, for me, because I was, broken hips aren't funny, and Ruby Mulvaney has a broken hip in that scene. What I had to do early on was I had to convince the reader that cars and people you love have a great deal to do with each other. And so from the beginning, Ruby Mulvaney is made up, like the Corvette itself, of parts. And in her case, none of the parts work as they should. She was made on a Monday. And yet, like many people I've grown up with, truly in Sandersville, I mean, I could name you a dozen such people, who bear up under just, you know, incredible adversity, you know, with just such great spirit and you know, goodness and lack of gallantry, lack of complaining or whining. And also we needed a moment where I was going to explain to you that Earl was going to have to drop out of high school and he's going to have to care for his mother, and we had to pile up some bills so he'd have to go to work. And so I set about writing that scene. I'll tell you truly, I'm not sure what question you asked, so I'm just answering stuff at random now. Writing slapstick is the hardest thing I know how to do. It is so hard. Because as a writer, you're told, show, don't tell. Right? How many of you ever heard that advice, you know, somewhere in a writing class? Show, don't tell. Well, in slapstick, you really can't show or tell. You've got to leave a blank so the reader gets it without being told. So, for example, in the scene we're trying to get Ruby Mulvaney out of the house on a creeper, one of those little rolling things you go under the car back before they had hydraulic lifts. There's a scene where he's got to get her through the kitchen door. He's afraid there's a bump over the threshold. She's lying pointed the wrong way on the creeper, and he's just going to roll it across. And she's got to stretch out her arms like Superman, and she's got to push down at a certain moment to get over the threshold. That moment is only described to you after they're already past the threshold. And she says something like, you know, did I look like Superman? He says, well, you know, Superman doesn't fly that low to the ground. He didn't fly backwards, but except for that, you look just like him. And then we discover she also knocked over a floor lamp. Or another moment is the chili scene. You know, you've got the oscillating fan. Hopefully the funny part comes before it's described to you. You've heard that Jennifer has thrown up, and then you hear about the oscillating fan. And that's supposed to create the image in the mind even before it's described. I'm not sure if I answered your question, but I answered a question. Is there anything else you can tell? There's a couple of moments in the novel, you know, also as far as physical humor. This is a brutal story. I mean, dang, you know, you can't turn a page without somebody getting cancer or getting beat up or going to the hospital or some terrible thing. And a lot of times, you know, I was in a position of having to get humor out of someone else's physical pain. And so I'm glad of that scene.
Much talked about by the students about this creeper, and this whole scene is one of the funniest.
Well, I'm glad
funnier moments written in literature.
Well, tell me what I'm going to put you on the spot. What do you find notable about it?
You know, I just kind of, it's just hard to visualize that trying to get to the hospital with a broken hip, and that don't want to call the ambulance,
right.
Don't want to pile up bills. And that you could just sort of visualize dragging this thing and the woman in agony and trying to just crash it over so you can get down to this automobile. It's just kind of visual in your mind.
And I've known
quite an extraordinary scene.
I've been through a couple of scenes like this in my own life. Some friends of ours were in Iowa, and he slipped and broke his leg on the ice. And he said, "We don't have insurance. Get me to the hospital. Don't call the ambulance." So he piles in the car. He tells his wife, go inside and to ask him how much it's going to be. And, we don't want to commit to anything. And so she goes inside. And there's this, I mean, I stole dialogue directly from this. He goes to the nurse's station. And she says, my husband's got a broken leg outside. How much is it going to be? And the nurse just looks at him and says, what do you want us to do? Shoot it? Or another time, I heard my wife's tender voice coming from the kitchen. Man. And I came in. She doesn't really talk like that, but this time she did. I thought she wanted me to open a jar of pickles. And I come in, and this is before lunch, but she's holding a formerly white dish rag to her thumb, which is now as red as the back of one of these seats. And there's just, you know, and so she's cut herself doing something. And so I said, well, let's go wash it off. And we wash it off, and it obviously needs stitches. And so, you know, we're going to go to the hospital, get some stitches real quick. And she says, but honey, I've already cooked the fish. It won't be good when we get back, and we don't know how long we'll have to be. So, you know, my wife, who takes no prisoner, she's sitting there holding a rag with one hand to staunch the flow of blood, eating with the other hand. I'm eating it, too. And it was darn good fish. I mean, my wife's a good cook. And then we went to the hospital. So, anyway. Any other questions? I told you to be careful what you asked me. Go ahead. Yes.
There's a lot of serious and humorous romantic imagery. And I have to ask, with the Endless Corvette part, the idea of reconstructing out of something, is there, in your head, deeper meaning that you're carrying around with that?
I'm scared to say this, because I want people just to be entertained by
it
the personal. There is to me. I mean, honestly, and I had a sort of rule about writing this book. You know, you can't hold one of these characters still for 5 minutes without him spilling some sort of crackpot notion of the universe.
Yeah.
And just about every idea that's trotted out, you know, at various times I've seriously thought, you know, I seriously thought about it. And I think Jimmy Wiggins and Mr. Thigpen, I grew up around a lot of fundamentalists, and I took them very seriously. You know, they're serious people. They're not unintelligent. And I sort of find Jimmy Thigpen's critique of Christianity. The fact is, folks, machines are evolving. You can say what you will. It's absolutely certain they're evolving. But, you know, I took Jimmy's critique of religion as very serious to me. You know, if we all turn the other cheek, then what happens? You know, sooner or later the cheek slackers are going to outnumber the cheek turners, and then where are we? I'm kind of serious about that. You guys are going to stone me. I'm sort of serious when Jimmy Wiggins says, well, you know, Christianity is the kind of religion you'd come up with if you were a 30-year-old bachelor who never had a mortgage. There's a seriousness there. But I had a rule with it that the more attractive the philosophy was, to me, the more I had to put it in the mouth of someone who in some way was discreditable, because I never want a reader to say, oh, here's the message. You know, man, Martin wants me to floss more often or something. I don't want to teach anybody anything. I just want to lay out a bunch of possibilities. So, you know, for example, a scene, this is another scene that people have, you know, quarreled with sometimes, but I think it's important. Everett Horton shows up, and he's a loan shark and just beats the ever-living snot out of Earl Mulvaney. Yeah, and the thing is, he has something to me that's actually very beautiful to think about. You know, that if he says his name over and over again, he forgets who he is. And once I don't know if I'm that light or the rug or the air or the bird noises outside, death is impossible. And that's such a beautiful idea to me, personally, that it was dangerous in this story, because I don't want to tip the story over. And so I put it in the mouth of a loan shark. Another person I think that, that's a good point. Judge Hathorne says something. He talks about, you know, a lot of Christians who basically are putting a bet on eternity. You know, it doesn't cost much and you might win the big prize. And I sort of say, yeah, you're right. But Judge Hathorne is a crook. And he's as crooked as a dog's hind leg. And then I could let characters that you like Ellen and Earl and Jimmy, put forward ideas that were purely playful. But by the end of the book, you know, to some extent, maybe you even buy those. So, anyway, yeah, I mean, this book was kind of a wrestling match with me with different notions I had about, you know, what life might be about. Then there's a lot of searches in the story. Earl's searching for parts, they're searching for treasure, Mr. Moss is searching for a dog, everybody's looking for something. Many people think they found it. I don't say they haven't. But I didn't, you know, I wanted to leave it unsettled. I wanted to leave it unsettled at the end. So.
Was
yes.
there any special memory of yours that had to do with the only thing you could cook was eggs?
I guess that was the first, thing I did learn to cook. And I just, I don't have a memory with eggs. I have memories of Sandersville, Georgia, which is sort of where this town is really set, you know. There was a certain time of year when they'd burn leaves and there'd be a mist in the air. And this sounds so silly. Oh, you guys are going to think I'm so pokey. But really, there was a street, it was Worthen Street, and there was this old garage that I didn't know enough to say, that's picturesque. And I tell you what, if I told any of my friends at school about this, they would have whipped my ass. They would have said, oh my God. But I walked by this, you know, and I just remember walking by, and it somehow it was so pretty and so sad. And it struck me even as a kid that way, you know, in a way I couldn't define. And there was a kid I knew named Johnny Smith, who, if anybody was going to take care of his mother and cook her scrambled eggs and grits every night for dinner, that would have been him. But no, you know, nothing really. The secret to cooking eggs is you got to saute some onions first. And I make good scrambled eggs. He didn't make them that good. But he hard scrambles them. There's nothing worse than slimy scrambled eggs. So that's good. That's good. Yes?
I'm curious about your ending. How you decided on it. You said something earlier which kind of gave a hint because you like to leave things unsettled.
Well, and I tell you truthfully, the ending decided itself. When I first started this story, I hope I'm not giving away to anything to anybody who hasn't read it. When I first started this story, I had a real clear ending in mind. Here was the original ending. Long time was going to pass. Earl would continue working on the Corvette. Troy would die. Natural causes. Earl would show up at Ellen's doorstep. You know, I love you, darling. Corvette's outside. Let's go for a ride. She says, I love you, too. They get in the Corvette. They drive away. Sort of across, like chitty, chitty, bang, bang. The car was going to sort of disappear. And at some point in writing the novel, I realized, folks, that's the actual ending to Love in the Time of Cholera. It's a boat instead of a car. Like, I'm rewriting Marquez, but I don't care. I mean, I have no pride. But then at some point in the story, I really realized that the story, that really was not going to happen. that really what was going to happen was going to be a question mark. And in a way, I sort of defeat one of the concepts of the story. There is no resolution in this story. I say, well, this might happen, this might happen. The story does a lot of eating its own cake and having it too. And the ending had to sort of be consistent with that. And it's really delightful when you're writing something and at some point the characters or events take over and you realize they're making choices. You know, your job is just to be faithful to what will happen. The ending was, the ending was mistier than I expected. I thought some pretty cut and dry. I knew it had to be a peculiar ending. Plus, I don't think I could, even I don't know if I could go quite so far as to try to tell you that building a Corvette this way is actually possible.
Yeah, one of the other really, comic themes is, of course, concerns the bees. Can you talk a bit about
that? The bees.
The bees, yeah.
That was another scene where my publisher and my agent and readers and I have gotten into wrestling matches before it was published. Various people read it, and it's actually a real staple of Southern humor is the bee hunt. The bee hunt always ends the same way. You know, you either don't get the honey or you get it and you wish you had. You know, it's been done by Twain has done it. Joel Chandler Harris has done it. It's been done in any number of children's books and all sorts of other stuff. And the story uses it's very self-consciously Southern. Like, this is the place where all the rural myths, like urban myths, all the rural myths live in Deep Step. You know, you've heard about these. Here they are, the real models from which, the stories were based. And so I wanted the bee chase in there. And actually, the version that's in there is considerably shortened from the original. If you looked at the novel, y'all are familiar with the arc of a novel. You know, there's a rising action and falling action. Well, Corvette is actually, it's pretty much, life is hard for Earl. It gets harder and harder and harder and harder, the end, a traditional novel is boy gets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. This novel is boy gets girl, boy loses girl. So I needed a spot just before the bee chase, the reader learns, but Earl has not, that Ellen is pregnant. And with Troy's baby. And that should be a painful moment. And it should be kind of awful thinking, this is terrible to do to a reader, but I really want to do this to a reader. I want to say, look, you're going to have to dwell with this knowledge that you can't share with Earl yet. You're going to have to anticipate the fact that what he loves and what he hopes for is not going to come to him. Okay, and I want you to deal with that. And then the next scene after the bee chase is when Earl learns, along with the rest of us. And I needed a pause. And Bill Shakespeare, who's like a close personal friend of mine, he told me, Martin, here's what you do when you have a moment like this. If I've had Macbeth kill Duncan backstage, the audience knows Duncan's dead, nobody else knows it yet, and in a second everybody else is going to find that Duncan's been murdered. We got to have a moment. Here's the moment. Drunken Porter comes out, does a bunch of drunk jokes, right? We've got a moment in there of that. It's the moment the clowns come out and everybody juggles. And there's, you call it comic relief, but the real purpose is to keep that suspense in play, to draw out that moment without just saying, well, we're going to have 20 pages of adverbs or something to make you wait for the conclusion to this. And then later the bee chase, provides a nice little bit, because they're his punishment. He feels in some way he's betrayed Ellen, and these are his memory of that. Plus, it's, you get a chance to write a scene where they knock down a beehive with a brassiere. I mean, goodness, you can't avoid something like that. It's like, that's cold. That's cold. Any guess? Oh, sure. I've got lots of answers. Yes.
In my reading, I may have missed something earlier, but it was not until about a third of the way through the book that I realized that the voice of the narrator was the librarian.
Well, and
what was your thinking behind that?
I, I didn't have any real clear thinking behind that. I think you're a good reader, because I don't think it's until about a third of the way book, or even third of the way through, or even more, that we find out that it is the librarian. When I first previewed this story for a writing workshop, one of the things that my professor danked me on, he said, well, the narrator in this doesn't make sense. He's an omniscient narrator. He tells us what people are thinking. Yeah, and so a first-person narrator can't know that. You know, if I'm the librarian, I cannot possibly tell you a deathbed secret unless it's whispered to me. But on top of that, not only is he a first-person omniscient narrator, he's unreliable. He tells you things that aren't so. He can tell you what Ruby Mulvaney or Jimmy Wiggins was thinking when they died. He can't seem to recall a Bible verse. He says, "I can't remember this verse." You know, he'll tell you he doesn't know what happened to Daisy. I don't know what happened to her. And then he'll tell you things that are just flat whoppers. Do you know when Earl rescues Jennifer from the fire? None of that happened. I mean, nothing happened. He walked in. He walked out, had the baby in his arms. All the stuff about the conflagration, you know, there ought to be a moment when you're reading when it's a calm scene and suddenly, what's going on here? Cinders are falling down from the ceiling, and it's like a scene out of Towering Inferno, which Earl had just seen. So the narrator is, he's unreliable, he's first person, he's omniscient. I'm slowly getting to your question. And my professor dinged me on that. He said, well, you know, I like the story, but. And so I went through conscientiously and tried to comb the narrator out of the story. And I just couldn't do it. If you take it out, the story is just flat. And so I was married to this narrator. And basically, it's like a publisher is either going to accept it with his narrator or the story can't work at all. And then my editor said that we really did need to know who the narrator was. And at that point, I suggested he be the librarian. And my editor said, yeah, that's good.
Because it's really cheap.
It's really a she. Oh, you're right. It's a she. Now that, of course, it's a she. Of course, it's a she. It's a she. Absolutely, absolutely. And she's a lovely woman. She likes to wear this red and white sort of check shirt with a white turtleneck. But she's a wonderful person. That's it. That's it. Yes. So, yes.
What's next? And what was your PhD dissertation?
Well, of course, in literature, my dissertation actually is in Endless Corvette. Rather creative writing, which is pretty sweet. Lord help me, I'm working on another novel, and I'm going to give you guys a piece. This is free of charge, by the way. This is a pearl I'm about to give you, so be ready to catch it. If you know any young man who's about to propose marriage, okay, this is what you got to tell him to do. Do not show up with a diamond ring. Don't show up with a diamond ring. It's been done. What you do is you show up with 12 loose diamonds, and you spread them in her lap, and you say, darling, take your pick. Now tell me that won't work. The main character in this story is trying to be reunited with his estranged first wife, and he does that. Unfortunately, he mislays the diamonds, and so the rest of the story is consequence dealing with that. And it's got a lot of stuff going on. It's got a communist conspiracy. It's got a, I mean, I can't tell you. I think it's a fun story. I think it's a fun story. And it's set in Central Florida in the 1960s.
What's his title?
The working title is Paradise Dogs, because the family used to own a hot dog restaurant, which is failed. Lord, I swear to God, you guys are going to learn not to ask me and Mark a question. Unasked, again, I'll tell you the genesis of this story. My wife and I very quickly saw a documentary on hot dogs on the 4th of July one time, and it was riveting. Oh, it's fascinating. And I had a dream that night that we had a hot dog restaurant in Athens, Georgia. And we were making so much money, you couldn't shut the till because just money was just jammed up, and it was falling on the floor, and all we could say is, we're going to run out of food soon, and we can lock up, and we can sweep up the floor and count the profits. And I woke up the next morning, and it's like, we're going to open a hot dog restaurant. And then, cooler heads prevailed, and I said, I will never open a hot dog restaurant. I could write about a hot dog restaurant. Now, this is the way I tend to come up with stories. Follow me like a hawk on this one. There is only one story you can tell about a restaurant. The restaurant succeeds, and then the restaurant fails. It can't be the restaurant succeeds unless it's a some sort of how-to book. It can't be the restaurant fails and then succeeds, because that's not interesting. It succeeds and then fails. And in various false starts, again, I've got to rewrite stuff. I rewrote the Ballad of the Sad Cafe. I did all sorts of reasons why this particular restaurant would fail. The real reason it fails is because the husband, Adam Newman, is always looking for perfection. And it doesn't exist. And so he screws up everything he comes across. In a hopefully amusing ways. So they said, I warned you all before we started. So another question from the librarian or anything? So, well, yeah.
That's why you chose a Corvette and not another car.
Well, of course, and I say this with all sincerity, there was no other car. The only, if Corvettes had not existed, it could have been a Mustang. But Mustang would have honestly been a distant second. If I was going for a different kind of story, it could have been an Edsel. But that would have, you know, that would have been a different kind of story. I needed a car, and ask yourselves this, folks. I mean, there's kind of a logical determination. I needed a car which was going to be somehow mythic and represent young romantic love. What's it going to be? And in particular, it had to be the 1953 Corvette, because there were very few of those made. And it is, truthfully, a legendary car. You know, it couldn't be a Stingray, although those are beautiful cars, because there's kind of enough of those around. But if you saw a 1953 Corvette in someone's shed that had never run, and, you know, like the first year, it was a car that just needed more maintenance than later models. You know, it had certain issues and bugs that had to be worked out, and it gives a mechanic kind of fodder to work with. So yeah, there was no question it had to be a Corvette. I was gratified. I've never seen a 53 Corvette in person, if that's the word. And they're as pretty as they can be. They're a pretty dang little car. So that's it.
At WKU's Helm Library, the interaction between the author and the audience continued.
Yes, sir.
I still didn't get it.
You still didn't get what?
I didn't.
The cat?
Yeah.
This is something I'm not making up. The idea is wait for it, guys. Oh my God. In theoretical physics, there's a concept called uncertainty or indeterminacy, and the idea is that at some level, oh God, how much of this do you want to hear? Certain things, they're not waves, they're not particles. Depending on how I want to test them, it'll be a wave or a particle, depending on what I want it to be. It's not one or the other until there is an observer. Okay? So what you have to imagine here, now I'm not sure how I feel about this. I think Troy stretches it a little bit. Certain events are neither one thing nor the other. And that's usually like at the really tiny scale of subatomic particles. You know, things so small, they don't have light. You know, they may not even be particles. And then maybe there's some way to rig it so that that principle of indeterminacy would be at the bigger scale. And the Schrodinger's cat is this. You've got a box, inside there's a cat. You shoot a subatomic particle in the box, just like I said. There's a 50-50 shot that it'll go through or be absorbed into the lining, and there's no way to know which it'll do. It's exactly 50-50. It's worse than the toss of a coin. There's no determining it. If it goes through, it'll kill the cat. If it doesn't go through, the cat will be fine. The idea is that the cat isn't one or the other until we open the lid and look on it. I don't know if I buy that one. I don't know if Schrodinger himself really bought it. How much of this can you guys stand? There's another thing that, and I will misquote it, a philosopher named Immanuel Kant, who's named after me, he had a set of rules, which was everything either, this Troy stole this, I forgot to put this in, so I sort of screwed it up, everything either is or is not. You can't be both, you can't be neither. But modern physics sort of says, well, maybe there are certain regions where things both are and are not. So that's more than you needed, wasn't it? Basically, I just wanted to get Ellen pregnant so we could have a baby scene in there. You know, if you've ever felt, well, I'll tell you what, if one day we hope, you know, this is a special experience for husbands, I'm sure it is for wives too, to reach your hand out and feel your child move inside of your wife's belly is just a remarkable experience. So that's part of it too. So God, we got on the theoretical physics today. I tell you what, oh Lord Almighty. We've got to get off this subject. People are going to kill me after this. There's an interesting book, which is all sorts of strange things. It's called Who's Afraid of Schrodinger's Cat? And it's all sorts of little quick little articles about stuff like that. Because some of it is damn strange and real interesting. If you have no other questions.
Well, okay. You know, this morning you talked a bit about, you know, one of the fascinating characters in the book is the mother, Ruby. And tell us how you kind of conceived of that.
You know, one thing I had to do in this book, and I may give you substantially the same answer you've heard before, is I had to convince the reader that an automobile, which is made out of metal and fiberglass and plastic, has something to do with human love. And so Ruby Mulvaney is, so to speak, a lemon. You know, her body, it's as if she was made on a Monday. Her body is constantly falling apart. And the book, one of the running images or motifs or words, if you care to do a word search in this book, it'd come up a zillion times, is just the word part. The book itself is divided into five parts. And everything there is falling apart and people are looking for pieces. Ruby Mulvaney, in a way, is sort of, you know, every boy's first love is his mother, and Ruby Mulvaney is that for Earl. You know, she's the woman who loves him uncritically, who's always there for him right up until her death. And so in some ways, she had to herself be like a car, and especially a car that required a lot of, you know, mechanical attention, which is sort of the sort of person she is. And all sorts of strange little car metaphors run through the book, too. You know, human relationships are described in terms of transmissions and fuel mixtures and all the rest of it. So, yes.
Why did you decide to write?
Truly, if I don't write, I don't like myself. I used to draw cartoons. Cartooning also met that same need. I've got to feel like I'm going to wake up in the morning and work on something. And that is for myself or for self-expression or whatever it may be. And my wife Nancy would tell you, you know, generally I'm a pretty nice guy, but if I'm in a dry spell, I really don't have them very often. But you know, like after I finished Corvette, there was a time I didn't have another project. My wheels were spinning, to use a car metaphor. And I tell you what, I'm just pissy. Sort of passive aggressive, and I don't like myself. I feel petty, but I can't help being just sort of. And you know, generally, if I feel like, you know, tomorrow morning, I know what I'm going to wake up and be working on. And if I know that, I feel pretty good about the world. So it's not, you know, I mean, writers say this sort of stuff, and it sounds so incredibly hokey, but it's the real truth. I write because I really have to. I write because I'm happy when I'm writing, and I hope you all enjoyed the book. But none of you could have enjoyed it as much as I did. I mean, oh my gosh, when Mrs. Rayleigh and Ruby become close friends, tears are just rolling. Oh, I'm so glad. I mean, I didn't see that one coming at all. I was so happy to see it happen. I really got upset when Jimmy died. I had no idea he had a tumor. That was a real shock to me. You think I'm joking? But you know, suddenly I realized, oh my God. You know, I just thought he was eccentric. He's got a thing growing in his brain. And once I knew, I mean, I was certain of it. And that sort of took its course after that. So, you know, when you write, it's fun. You're both reading and writing at the same time. You know, the story is sort of unfolding in front of you. You just got to try to be true to it.
Well,
Yes.
When you were writing the book, did you discuss any aspect or character or situation with your classes?
I try to keep my writing away from my classes, and just because the power relationship is such that, you know, I mean, I don't keep it a secret. They know where I am right now, and they know I have a book, but I haven't said, you know, you need to read my book or offered it for sale. They said, can you buy your book? I said, yeah, go to the Borders, you know, or it's on Amazon.com. And if they read it and like it, I say, oh, I'm glad you liked it. If they don't read it, I say, welcome to class, you know. So I don't talk about it. I don't talk about it too much. So this makes a nice opportunity because I love to talk about myself.
Did they not ask you about it? Or?
They do sometimes, and sometimes, you know, some of my classes, students haven't known about it. But they do and they don't. You know, this is not a bad thing. The next thing I'm going to say is going to sound very cynical. It's not cynical. Most people care most deeply and passionately about themselves. And God bless them for doing so, because I do too. And, you know, my world is pretty circumscribed, me and my wife and my children and the dog, and sometimes not in that order. And I don't really, you know, sometimes when we're working on, if we're doing creative writing, I'll try to say, you know, I have some knowledge of this. You know, you'll have to trust me when I say, try this, this will work better than that. But it's very difficult to look at your writing and say, it's extremely difficult for high school students, especially anybody, to say, okay, you're right, let's take this out, because I tell you what, you put those words down, you thought about every one, and you can take scissors to them? I don't think so. It's hard to do.
Will you do a sequel, or will you go off on a different direction?
I don't intend a sequel, and my wife says never say never, but as far as I'm concerned, these characters have had their say, and I'm putting them away in the closet. I'm working on another story now. Tracy's heard about it somewhat. My next story is Southern also in a different way. It's set in Central Florida in the 1960s, back when that region of the country had a very Southern culture that was somewhat different than Georgia. As Tracy mentioned, I was born in Ocala, Florida. Here's my shtick. I mean, this is all I ever try to do in writing, is like that. I want it to be, if I can make it, as funny as I can possibly make it, and as sad as I can possibly make it. And that's pretty much it. If I can mix those two together, I'll feel good. And I think it does it. I think it's heading there anyway. You know, there's this. Tracy's heard the spiel, and so have you. So forgive me. Here's a secret for you. And some young men left. I was just about to give them a pearl. You can't tell this to a future fiance, but anybody in this room who needs to propose marriage, here's how you do it. I'm going to give you a little golden nugget. Here's how you do it. Do not show up at the door with a ring. Don't come up with a ring. What you want is 12 loose diamonds, and you spread them in her lap, and you say, darling, take your pick. Now tell me, huh? Will that work? Will that bring home the bacon? Just yes, right? Right? I mean, the various dweeb in the world can, you know, bring them in that way. Well, the main character in my story does exactly this, but then mislays the diamonds. And so the rest of the story is following that. And Endless Corvette takes place over decades. This story takes place over a little over a week. So it's kind of a fast-moving story. But I think it's called Paradise Dogs. But I'm still in the midst of some fairly substantial revisions, but I feel good about it. So there was a question there too, yes. Yeah.
I was wondering what effect you wanted to have on the reader with that narrator who is a specific character, but also narrates a whole bunch of things that we are sure he has no way of knowing.
That's a smart question. The narrator kind of showed up accidentally at first. I had previewed this in a writing workshop, and my students are a chapter of it. My fellow classmates, you know, liked the story and were, you know, said, oh, this is a lot of potential. My professor dinged me on that very question. He said, you know, man, you got an omniscient narrator who knows deathbed secrets and yet is a single person. He wasn't a librarian at that point, but he says he has dealt personally with Jimmy Wiggins. And on top of that, he's unreliable. He tells you stuff that isn't so. And I said, you're right. You're right, Dr. Holman. You're right. I know better than that. I don't know what I was thinking. And I went back and carefully combed that narrator out of the story, and it just went flat. I mean, it just went flat. And I realized the narrator was staying. And in some ways, it really is a story about the narrator. You know, it's about him telling you a story. And I think what I finally realized is, and so I didn't do it, I'm not smart enough to do something like that on purpose. I'm barely smart enough to recognize it if it works. And I think it was the second one. What I realized is this is a tall tale. This is a story in which impossible things will happen. You know, one of my favorite lines in the story is, you know, the undertaker's wife is selling a frock coat at a yard sale, and she says, I can't let you have this one for $12. My first husband was buried in this suit, you know. And it's a story where lines like that, you know, just sort of glide right under the door. To have a logically consistent narrator would be inconsistent. You know, this is a narrator who, you know, is going to have to spin you a tall tale. I was talking to a young lady earlier today, and she was saying that the character she doesn't like, maybe the only real villain in the piece, is Wayne, the other mechanic. And he's always called just Wayne, the other mechanic. And it's funny, and I agree with her, I don't like Wayne either. Except Wayne, in the whole car dealership, he's the only one who's honest. After the fire, he's the only one who's got the straight version of events. And yet, you don't like him. So at the end of the day, you prefer the person who will tell you a pleasant lie and has some warmth and affection to the truth. And at the end of the day, you'll accept, you know, that. And that's sort of the nature of a tall tale. At the end of the story, I think, was it you who asked me about the ending of the story? Someone in earlier did. The ending of the story is real, you know, ambiguous. But it's the story, it's the end of the story, has his cake and eats it too. He says, you know, in a series of real short sentences, he does like three flip-flops. He says, I saw a dinosaur over the parking lot of the Piggly Wiggly. And he says, but it wasn't a dinosaur. It was a dinosaur. They were serving waffles. It wasn't a dinosaur. It was just a light pole. And then he says, and I thought it was a brontosaurus, but it couldn't have been a brontosaurus. No such thing as brontosaurus. It must have been a diplodocus. And so now, it's been a dinosaur, it's been a light pole. Now we're back to a dinosaur. And then he says, I don't insist that the dinosaur was really there. The very next sentence he says, but it was there. And so, you know, but if this is the effect on the reader, by that point in the story, you know, reality is such a fog for you. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And you're willing to, you know, it's like Schrodinger's cat. You're willing to accept simultaneously there was a dinosaur, there wasn't a dinosaur, the dinosaur was a light pole, the dinosaur was a brontosaurus, it was a diplodocus. And at some point of your consciousness, you're probably also thinking, you know what? I saw that same dinosaur. I know the one he's talking about. So, anyway, I hope that answers your question. Maybe it was too late.
Yeah, tell us a bit about how you weave in one of the subplots, which is about the buried treasure. A lot of southern towns have this.
I've never lived in a southern town, at least in Georgia, that didn't have Confederate treasure buried somewhere. We all, you know, and I've lived in three towns in Georgia, and all of them had, you know, because every Georgian, God help them, they're all convinced we were wealthy. You know, we were wealthy. We were all rich, and you know, we had the treasure. But, you know, we're wealthy, but we were stupid. And so we buried the treasure and can't find it. And, you know, there is this persistent belief. And it's shown up in other stories. Faulkner uses it somewhere. And in the novel as a whole, people are always looking for something. And so one of the things they're looking for is the treasure. And then something else happened. And I don't know, this was a big play in Georgia. I don't know if it got all the way up to Kentucky. I think it was on the national news for a while. There was a hideous, gruesome scandal with a crematorium in North Georgia. and thank God, oh my Lord. And you hear this sort of thing and you're disgusted, but if you're a writer, you're thinking, oh, I can use this. This lunatic, you know, the crematorium broke down. I don't even know how that's possible exactly. Rather than repairing it, he simply, you know, pocketed the cremation fees and just deposited bodies. And apparently once bodies are have been embalmed, they're nigh on indestructible. I mean, they're like Wonder Bread. They never go bad. And so having heard this, you know, I thought, I mean, all I can say, that was just so good. And at the same time, you know, all these little strange events come in. They were draining a lake near our house. And if you've ever seen a lake drained, it's really gross and interesting at the same time, because stuff that was buried is gradually submerged, and there's this mud flat. And then if you care to go fishing, at some point, you can just about, you know, pick one out of the water, because they get really dense in there. So for, I mean, there's a morbid streak in me. I thought it would be amusing if they found a buried treasure. And of course, the three things they think it might be, and I'm just going to tell you, I'm shameless with puns, is the bell from the First Baptist Church. It might be the pipe organ, or it might be these pigs, which are gold or silver ingots. And so, of course, what it is three coffins. There's Mrs. Bell, Mrs. Keys, who's the pipe organ, and, of course, Mrs. Hogg, or Mr. Hogg, who is the pigs. And so, you know, there's always, in this story, no matter how far-fetched your quest is, sooner or later you'll find what you're looking for. Roy Mulvaney has a gambler's fallacy, which is like the most basic fallacy in the world. You know, if I had 23 busted flushes, I'm more likely to make a flush the next time. At the end of the book, his prophecy seems to come true. He suddenly starts drawing all these flushes. Ellen has this cockamamie idea that time moves backwards and forwards, but by the end of the book, by golly, that's not exactly what it seems to be doing. I'm thoroughly convinced now cars are evolving into fish. You know, I don't know I forgot where this question started, so pardon me, I'm a terrible rambler.
Buried treasure stuff.
But buried treasure, yeah, just the idea of looking for something, and the other running motif is of buried treasure. You know, you'll find something, but you know, it's not always what you wanted. Another, you know, warning sign to a reader is anytime somebody says, "This is just like Christmas," the next thing was going to be nasty. You know, you need some heaven help, and you say, "It's like Christmas." Christmas in the story is not always nice. But yes, yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
You did something, I don't know how to put this, but when Jimmy was dying, you had him mouth some glowing words about Ruby, and then you made a comment that you'll go to heaven if you have very positive thoughts, and that you go to hell if they're negative. Where did you get that idea?
Someone, and I attributed it to and then I changed the name of the car manufacturer. There was a car manufacturer whose name was something B, and I changed it to Buran because I thought, well, maybe someone in the family is going to be upset if I use his name. But the details about the bowling alley and the other stuff he owned was true. I think this was something my mother told me one time as just speculation, and I'm not sure where she got it. But to me, it's a beautiful idea, and the idea is there is no afterlife. There isn't one. You know, the date on your death certificate is it. That's where the curtain closes, except if you've ever been in some sort of disaster, you know, like a car wreck, notice how time dilates and slows down, okay? And so death would be like that. It would slow down so much that eventually it would just kind of stop. So there is an afterlife, but you would never actually reach that moment. And so what is heaven or hell is your last moment. And your last moment will be the moment the truest, deepest you will come out. If what's inside of you is love and hope and generosity, that will be heaven. If what's inside you is fear and selfishness and hate and envy, that's it. And so ultimately, the last moment of your life is your afterlife. And that was a pleasant idea to me, an intriguing one, so I put it in there. And the narrator is as faithful as he can be when he says, I try hard not to come down on one side or the other. Because I don't want the narrator to lecture you or say, well, this is the answer, you know, this is it. So you had a hand up too.
I have a question about the theme of reading throughout.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like once I knew you were a high school teacher, it made me start looking for all the things you kind of planted in there to make people want to read other books.
Oh,
and
well.
Kind of get hooked on reading. Was that conscious or did they just kind of bubble up?
Partly it was conscious and partly, you know, whatever... You know, I'm whatever pieces of detritus are floating around me when I'm writing, I'm very suggestible. Whatever's happening around me just seems to be incorporated into that scene. And since, at the time, actually, I was taking a course at Georgia State, too, on Victorian novels. So there's a lot of Jane Eyre there and other stuff. So whatever's happening just sort of gathers to me. And, you know, I'm a shameless punster, and I love making allusions to other works. So a lot of the characters in there are actually references to other works. Judge Hathorne is actually a character in The Scarlet Letter, who is also Nathaniel Hawthorne's ancestor. The woman who owns the diner is Daisy Miller, who's a character, I think, by Henry James. Is that
Henry
right?
James.
Is that right? Okay. And who else is in there? Barbara Allen. There's an old ballad called Barbara Allen. So, and she was from that. And Barbara Allen always struck me as something of a strumpet in that ballad. Earl Mulvaney. I mean, this bears no relationship to the other book, but there's a wonderful and terrible book by Joyce Carol Oates called We Were the Mulvaneys, which is kind of painful reading. It's a beautiful book. Who else? Oh, and of course, you know, Ellen and Troy. Is Helen of Troy, of course. Some puns are so embarrassing I can't even explain to you what they mean. Troy's last name is Badcock. We won't talk about that. It's another thing I can play with, you know. And of course, Ellen is smart, and so she reads a lot. And so she reads literature. And I had a lot of fun with, when Earl and the other people at the dealership would talk about literature. There's a real funny scene in Huck Finn where Jim and Huck are talking about Don Quixote. So I wanted to have my own run at that and see what they would make of it. Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Two quick things. First of all, the belief in that how you see the afterlife is colored by your last moments is actually a part of Buddhist belief and American spiritualist belief.
Right.
Secondly, I'd have to laugh about the buried treasure, because I'm from South Carolina, we all believe the same thing.
Yeah.
And it does happen, although somebody else sometimes finds your treasure.
Right.
My great-grandfather on maternal side dug up somebody else's treasure and probably ran away with it. Then abandoned the family.
Well, the other, and in Georgia in particular, the other recurrent story is that this town was spared by Sherman because the mayor was a Masonic brother. The mayor was an in-law. And if all the towns, and so Sherman came to this town and did a detour around the town. Well, Sherman's army would have had to have been, you know, just massive, you know, to sweep across, you know. And actually, frankly, he probably spared the town because the town was so unimportant that, you know, you didn't have a railroad. It really pretty much didn't matter that much. Here's another one that I've always heard, and I now know, I'm sure I know where this came from. I've lived in three Georgia towns. Each one of them had this same ghost. There'd be an old antebellum house, and there was a woman who would throw herself out of the balcony every night at midnight. You've had the same ghost. Here's who she is. Not who she is. This is what it is. There is a particular owl. We've got one in our neighborhood that makes a cry. It's beautiful, and it'll raise goose flesh. For all the world, it sounds like a falling woman. It goes, I can't do it. It's like, you can just about hear the thump at the end of it. And you know what? If you were walking by an old house and you heard that, you could walk a little faster. I mean, it's like, okay, I think I'll keep moving. But there's certain, or another story I heard all the time. I tried to find this on the internet because I just know I've heard this a million times. is Daisy's Diner. That there would be this diner at the junction of two dry counties. And when the sheriff came from one county, she just moved to the other side. And when he came, you know, and there's a scene like that in Sergeant York. But I couldn't, and I know I've heard this from multiple sources. You know, sometimes it's in South Carolina, sometimes in North Georgia. I looked for it on the internet. I couldn't find it.
It's either a diner or a brothel.
It's a diner, a bar, or a brothel. That's a good word for it. And sometimes she's a moonshiner, which Daisy is a little bit, you know. But always can elude the authorities that way. You always hear about urban myths. There is a set of rural myths too that we have in the South. So. All right, well, folks, if there's no other questions, thank you all so much for coming out.